Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, it's Annie McManus here. Welcome to Changes, a very special revisited version of the podcast for you this week, where we look back at two rather remarkable conversations and bring them to you in a neat Easter package. So, this week we are jumping back into one of our most popular episodes ever with Irish comedian Joanne McNally, as well as an early Changes episode with a woman called Susan Herdman, who you won't know, but won almost £1.2 million on the lottery and talked to me all about how that changed her life. So first up, phenomenally successful comedian Joanne McNally, also from Dublin like me, is the co-host of the hugely popular podcast My Therapist Ghosted Me with her friend Vogue Williams. She's currently touring her sellout show The Prosecco Express across the world, currently in Australia, back in the UK and Ireland in May to take the podcast on tour with dates all the way through till December. Joanne's popularity stems in her just brutal honesty when it comes to being a woman in her 30s and 40s. And she has garnered a huge, sprawling fan base of women who find her absolutely hilarious because of her quickness and her wittiness and her dryness and the confessional aspect to what she does as well. She's a godsend for women. And in this episode, she spoke about her upbringing, being adopted, school, her days of feeling lost with what to do, studying and working in PR. She was also completely open about her struggles with bulimia. So we're going to revisit the end of that journey before she got into comedy and where everything changed for her. Joanne McNally.
I have to say, like, when I think back, I didn't realize how grim it was at the time. I don't mean to make it sound like it's really it, but it is a difficult thing to get over because you can't get away from food or your body.
No.
You have to look at your body and you have to eat and all those things. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, it was a tough one, but I did it. I think I include lads in this now as well. But like, so many women I know have a touch or have had very severe
Or have it and don't even know they have it.
Yeah.
You know, or would have it till they're old. And just say, oh, I'm just a funny eater or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's all of that, isn't it?
Sometimes I even think, like, I probably get ripped for saying this now. When I see young girls and they're vegan, I'm like, oh God, sometimes I wonder, is it just for some of them, is it a way of
shrouding an eating disorder.
Yeah, yeah, I do. And like, obviously there are people who are vegan for, you know, ethical reasons, and it's all legitimate, but I do. But also I think being a young girl now, they've much more, all that body positivity. Like, we grew up in the same time, there was no such thing as body positivity. It was thin was in.
I was born in 78. So I was a teenager at the start of the 90s, like heroin chic,
Kate Moss.
Yeah. All of that, like, stick, rake,
yeah,
in.
Yeah, juicy couture, hanging off your rib cage, hanging off your thigh bones. It was bone. So, oh God, there was no Roma. Like, even when even Lizzo now and all, you're like, that's so dead.
Yeah.
Like, we never had that.
Yeah. But you know what, Joanne? Like, it's so good that you talk about it in such a candid way in your comedy. Like, now, like, just to come out and talk about it and vocalize it, there'll be so many women who are just...
It's
I'm
so
sure
common.
You've had so many messages from people about
it. I did. So I did a show. So when I was unwell, I used to write, I had this anonymous blog called Eat the Pastry. And then a friend of mine sent it to someone in the Indo. And then I got a column, but it wasn't about bulimia. It was just a column about whatever was going on. And but then a friend of mine, Una McKevitt, who's gone on to kind of direct most of my shows, she was the one who put, so basically what happened, how I got into comedy then was, so I was doing this program in Vincent's and floating around, nothing to do. And Una was putting on she works in the arts, she's a director, and she was putting on a play called Singlehood, which was the cast. I think there was 9 of us, and it was half real people in inverted commas, i.e. people who aren't actors.
Actresses or actors, yeah.
And then half comics talking about their love lives. And I had been, this is the maddest thing. When I was unwell, I've never had more boyfriends in my life. Yeah. Because I always, I was like, this will fix it now. This man will fix
you
it.
Were, you were kind of going out trying to find people, or were they coming to you? Like, how was it?
Well, it's a, it was a mix. Firstly, I look back and I was like, I kind of find it even just upsetting for men that they're told that that physique is attractive when I was do you know what I mean? But as well, when I started the program, I was kind of out partying and stuff because there's no food involved in partying.
Yeah.
But anyway, 3 months and they'd realize I was deranged and they'd be like, you're grand. That was it. Every 3 months, boom, it's over. Boom, it's over. Like clockwork.
Right.
And one lad, I'd just been broken up with by this lad and he was bald and I was fuming and I was telling this story about getting broken up with this bald lad, blah, blah, blah. And then Una was like, just tell that story. And so that's, I went into single and started telling that story. And then there was another comic who saw it and he was like, I think you should do stand up. And that's kind of how it started.
Okay.
So if I hadn't been unwell, this would never have happened. So in a way, I wouldn't change it.
It's all kind of led to there. So you never had any designs or like desires to do stand-up comedy?
No.
Or had it just not occurred to you?
It had never occurred. Yeah. It had never occurred to me. And I was very lucky in that he was very enthusiastic. He was very encouraging. Una was very encouraging. I had a lot of people kind of pushing me along into it. Because I mean, it's a bananas career choice. Who the fuck, you know? And for someone, I had such a normal job. I was in PR, you know.
Yeah.
There was no Southside women doing comedy that I know. Maybe I'm wrong, but there wasn't. It wasn't really a thing. Because as I was told, no one will listen to your accent for an hour, which I was told relentlessly.
God.
Yeah. But so no, that was a total curveball. I just got really lucky with timing and met the right people and then just worked hard at it, you know. Once I realized, oh, I could actually do this.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'd much rather, this feels like me now. I was having to do a lot of therapy on myself, figure out what I wanted. I think the bulimia anorexia was part of an identity crisis that a lot of people, like a lot of people go through that. They're like, who the fuck am I? What do I want? And when I started doing stand-up and I was on the road touring and stuff with other comics, I was like, this is what I want.
Was there a moment in that, in those early years, where it all clicked and you felt like you actually could make a career out of it, as opposed to just like, oh, I know I want this, but like actually this is viable? Like,
yeah, I would have to admit, even though sometimes it's not a great side of myself, but I'm quite competitive, like a healthy amount. That's why I had to go back and study for my finals. I feel like if I'm going to do it, I need to do it. If I'm going to put everything I have into it, if I've made a decision. So the comedy was kind of like the sociology. I was like, right, fuck this. This is what I'm doing now. So everything goes into this. I basically swapped bulimia for stand up.
So you swapped trying to like make yourself smaller physically to like trying to like make your career bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just put everything into it. So I just did all the shit gigs.
Yeah.
I was coming back and forth. I got signed in the UK. I came over here. I was staying in fucking shitholes, cat homes, basically, because I had no money. I was like, I'm just going to make this work now.
Wow.
This is what I'm doing now. Yeah. And I was lucky in that. Well, when I moved to the UK, I'd no husband. I'd no kids. I've just put everything into comedy and myself, basically. It's actually a really nice thing to do. And I think even when I started, I used to really struggle with being on my own that much. I was going through a breakup at the time and I would cry on the trains and it was just, I felt so lonely. But the only time I wasn't sad was when I was on stage. So, but now I'm so mentally robust. My boyfriend's like, can you give me a call? Or
like, sorry, who are you? What's your name?
I'm like, I've gone completely 180. I am just so comfortable on my own that actually I find it hard to spend time with other people now. But I'd much rather this version of myself than the previous version of myself, because I was a bit of a mess. I was a bit of a mess, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got through it, and it sounds like you had to kind of just like turn the mirror on yourself and really go through a painful process, but to come out stronger and more resilient and more like knowing who you are. I think it takes a fucking long time for people to really know who they are and what they want. And some people can go through their whole life without knowing what they really want.
Big time.
Being forced to do that, as awful and painful as it was, it's kind of worked out in a really positive way.
And you know what's so interesting? I was kind of the mess when we were in our 20s, you know, with my friends and stuff. And they were seemed to know their shit. They were happy, and they were making really sensible decisions. They were getting married and they had long-term boyfriends and all this stuff. But then now some of them are a bit like what I was like in my 20s. They're a bit like, shit, is this it? Did I jump too quick? Did I make? And I'm glad that I actually, because again, the commitment phobia has, I am a bit of a commitment phobe, that I'm still, I keep saying single. I'm not single, but like in my brain, like that I'm.
You've got the single mind. You've got it in your mind that you are that person.
I think,
yeah.
I think of a single cell. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think of a single cell, but I'm glad that I've kind of kept myself I've no responsibilities, only myself. I'm my new boyfriend. He's new. I have a responsibility to him now, of course, but yeah. I've no mortgage. I've no kids. I can travel around.
Oh my God. And so to all your friends who are married with kids and literally like stuck, trapped, that's like, oh, the idea of having no responsibilities.
Yeah. Some of them are happy out, but some of them are like, I'd love a bit of that. I'd love a bit of what you have. But if you told me when I was 22, you're still going to be single at 39 with no house, no kids, I would have been like, I would have seen that as a failure.
Yeah.
But now I actually see it as a win.
Goes to show, life is not one size fits all, although we are often led to believe that and made to feel like we should reach certain milestones by a certain age. Joanne McNally is a wonderful, shining, hilarious and brilliant example of doing things your way. I would urge you to go and listen back to that full episode if you missed it, and go and see her live as well. Just head to joannemcnally.com for all the tickets you need.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so from one woman changing her life to another whose life changed overnight. In 2010, Susan Herdman won £1.2 million on the lottery. Before winning, Susan was a hairdresser who had had some difficult times in her life, including the breakdown of her marriage. There were times she didn't feel she could afford to put the heating on. To rewin, she has a new partner and a whole new way of life. Here, we revisit her telling us about the night her life changed forever.
I remember cooking tea and hearing Dale Winton's voice in the next room. And he always did the show In It to Win It.
Yeah.
Which I love quiz shows. So I thought, oh, so I ran through and I pressed pause without really looking at the screen. So I had no idea what I'd pause, but I just pressed pause. I went back into the kitchen, put my spaghetti carbonara on my plate, and I went through to the front room to eat it on my lap. And as I looked up, the numbers were frozen on the screen. And I looked and thought, oh, I've definitely got a couple. I think I might have 3 or 4 there. I'll check my ticket. So I put my tea down, went and got my ticket. And I literally kept looking. And I just thought, there is six numbers. So I got right up close to the screen and I checked it 4 or 5 times. And then I started shaking. And it was a $7.5 million rollover that night. So I started to shake. And then I thought, no, hang on a minute. Do not get excited, because I guarantee this will be the first night ever that they're going to have like 300,000 people have all got the same 6 numbers. So I then had to ring the number on the back of the ticket. So I misdialed about 20 times. I ended up climbing onto the worktop in the kitchen to get under the spotlight so I could get the number right. And then a lady answered and I said, I think I've won the lottery. I think she said, read out the barcode. It's all a bit of a blur.
Okay.
And then she said to me, right, keep the ticket, put your name and address on the ticket, keep it safe and write down this password, because tomorrow morning somebody's going to ring you from the lottery and they will say that password and then you'll know that they are legit. Right, okay. So I quickly put my name, shaking like this, wrote my name on the ticket and put it inside my bra.
Yeah.
I thought, it's safer in my bra. I couldn't eat anything. And it was still relatively early. So I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I was home alone.
So did you know how much you'd won then? Like,
no.
Was it confirmed that you had won?
No, no, nothing. I had the six numbers. I knew I'd got the six numbers. And I kept looking at, I did ask the lady from the lottery, how much do you think I've won? And she said, we won't be able to tell you that until about 10 o'clock tonight. So I got my calculator out and I was literally doing, I didn't even know how to put in 7.5 million. And I was dividing it by 300,000. And so all I kept thinking was, okay, look, if you could get 100,000, that's going to be pretty awesome. If you could get 10,000, there's nothing wrong with that, you know. So I was sort of telling myself this.
Yeah.
So anyway, I then decided I'm going to go to the karaoke. I can't stay home all night. It's going to be such a long night. So I still had my ticket inside my bra and I set off up to the karaoke and I never told a soul, not a single person. So I went to the karaoke and did not tell a single person. I was there with all my friends and every now and again I'd go into the ladies, lock the door and literally go, yes, just sort of do that and then go back out again. I sang, I had a few drinks. And
I really want to know what you sang. I like the idea of you singing like, you know, money, money, money or something.
Well, funnily enough, I was looking through the karaoke list of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or stuff like that. But I don't even know. I probably would have sang the usual karaoke very badly, I might add. I Will Survive, yeah. A bit of Grease, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Typical karaoke. Yeah.
So you were
room.
Going to the toilet and you were taking out the ticket and just making sure that it was
yes,
still real.
Yes, yes. Kept tucking it back in. And yeah. And then I think I got home at about midnight and I went onto my laptop and I saw that five people had won it and it was just short of 1.2 million. Well, that was just, I mean, what do you do? Oh, it was... From that second, there was no hysterics. There was no running around the room screaming. There was just this big, oh, thank God, thank you. Just relief, absolute relief that, you know, if I was careful, I'd be okay financially for the rest of my life. Just relief. I wouldn't have to just constantly be battling against the clock, listening to the phone, appointments. Relief, just absolute relief. Yeah.
So how did you sleep that night?
Not very good. Not very good at all. And I remember waking up in the morning and thinking, oh no, I dreamt it. It was a dream. And then sort of coming to and going, no, I didn't dream it. And then checked for the ticket and then like this, oh God, this just absolute.
And then did you get the call in the morning with the password and then the confirmation?
I did, but still no confirmation because it all has to be done official. But, you know, I had to tell them where I bought the ticket and roughly what time. And then they said that the lottery would be coming to my house. A representative from the lottery would be coming to my house. They asked me who I banked with. They like us to have a private bank account because if you put all that money in your sort of typical high street current account, you get inundated with offers of investments. So they said they would bring a sort of private banker. He would come about an hour or so after to sort out all the finances. I was still home alone. I hadn't told anyone. I'm still in the house all on my own. And my parents were coming down for lunch. So I phoned my mother at about 8 o'clock in the morning. And I said, what time do you think you're coming down? And she said, well, at lunchtime, it's only 8 o'clock. And I just said, okay. I said, well, don't be too long, you know, because it's a bit lonely. Well, it's only 8 o'clock. She said, we'll be there. So it got to 9 o'clock and I phoned her again. And she said, I said, have you not left yet? She said, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. What time are you doing lunch? I said, oh, fine. Don't worry. I'm just a bit lonely. That's all. So anyway, unbeknown to me, she said to my dad, look, we're going to have to go. There's something wrong with her. She's not right. Let's just go. So I think they did actually get to me for about 10:15. And my mother walked into the house and I said, where's dad? Oh, he's just gone to get some petrol. And I just went, oh, for goodness sake. And she said, what is wrong with you today? I said, nothing, nothing. Well, I'd got the numbers frozen on the screen in the lounge. We were in the kitchen. So my dad came in and I said, right, I need you both to sit down. So they both sat down and I said, something happened to me last night that's going to be pretty life changing. And they both sort of stared at me. My dad got a bit worried and my mum said, what's happened? And I said, I won the lottery. And at that point, I burst into floods of tears. And my mum, her mouth fell open and she's never speechless. And my dad literally jumped up and grabbed me and said, about bloody time. Sorry for swearing, but that's what my dad said. So, they were the first two people that I told. So it was pretty special time.
And you won with your dad's number?
Yes, I did. Yes. But he was absolutely, he's such a sweet man. There was never any, he never expected any of the winnings. He never asked for any. He just was so happy, genuinely happy.
So that was 10 years ago.
Yes.
Can you talk me through like what your life is like now?
Oh, very, very, very different. I mean, Andrew and I, our relationship was going along really good anyway. We were commuting to see each other. We got on really, really well. And the plan was that I would have to come to live in North Yorkshire if our relationship was going to go anywhere, because he had the family farm. So he couldn't up and leave here. So I would have had to sort of give up my salon and then come up here and get a job. Well, obviously then winning the lottery, it meant that having to get a job was not top of my priority. But it's really strange. I mean, you suddenly go from sort of turning your heating down because you're worried about what the gas bill's going to be to, well, actually, let's have the heating up a bit because we can afford to pay the bill now, to having all this money in the bank. And it's actually quite terrifying. It's your life has changed unbelievably. And so I didn't want, at that point, the rest of my life to change. My hair salon had been my rock. It had seen me through all my bad times. When I was living the lonely, lonely life, the salon was what kept me going. I didn't want to lose that. It was my anchor in life, and I didn't want to give that up. So I carried on working. Obviously, I no longer had a mortgage, so that was a massive weight off my shoulders. Andrew and I bought a very large motorhome. It's a lorry because we're both massive into motorsport. So you could actually put a car in the back of it. And it was a dream of mine. I'd drive up the motorway, see them and think, oh, if ever I win the lottery, when I win the lottery, I'm going to buy one of those. So we did buy one. Well, Andrew was also doing his motorbikes. So he'd arranged to go to a motorbike event in Austria in the May, and he was going with a couple of mates, and I couldn't go because I had my hair salon and I had clients booked in. I could not let those clients down. Off he went in our new race truck without me, and I was at work. And then in the July, I got to work early in the morning and I read an article in a magazine about an English lady that was married to a Spanish guy. They lived in Spain and she had an idyllic life. She taught English in a school. They had a little girl that they would take down to the beach every afternoon. And it was a really nice life. And then she was struck down with a debilitating illness, something like motor neurons, where she ended up just laying in a bed. Her brain and her mind were still active, but it took her whole body. And then she died. And it was just like a light bulb in my head. I suddenly thought, I'm 40. What am I doing? What are you doing? You've been given this gift of lottery money. You can travel the world if you want to. And yet this salon is still dictating your life, you know. And I felt that I was cheating my granddad, my dad, the dream I'd had to win it. What was the point of winning it if you were not going to change your life? So I rang the local paper, advertised my hair salon. It sold 4 days later. I did my last day on the 31st of July and I had no regrets. There was loads of tears from clients. They all wished me well. And then literally the following week, I woke up and for the first time, I actually enjoyed my little house that I'd bought. And I spent the sort of from the August until the following March commuting up to North Yorkshire, spending a week up here, spending 2 weeks up here just to sort of see if I liked it. And I loved it. So in the March, I decided to make the move permanent up here. We've continued to do our car racing with good results, mixed results. And we do love our motorsport. Andrew and I have had the luxury of doing some absolutely incredible holidays, bucket list stuff. You know, I've kept my house down south, which I've rented out ever since. I bought some property in York that I rented out to get my own money. I've just recently bought a property that I'm doing my first renovation, which is not going to be a success because I can't detach myself from a nice kitchen to just a, it's a difficult one. Yesterday morning, I was up at 4:40. We loaded pigs.
So you live on a pig farm now, right?
I live on a pig farm. Yes. Wow. Yes. A slightly different hairdressing, but it's a hard life, but it's a good life. Yeah. I think once you've been a worker, I don't think you're ever not going to work. I think you need a purpose to get up.
Yeah.
You know, what would you do all day if you didn't work? Yeah. You can't have, you know, I won nearly 1.2 million.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
It's a lovely, lovely amount of money, but it's not movie star money. You know, I can't live like a celebrity for the rest of my life, traveling here, there and everywhere without replenishing it. Mm. You know, I have to think of my son's future as well, you know.
So, I mean, it's very common for people when they win the lottery, 70% of lottery winners go bankrupt within a few years of winning it.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds that you have been so sensible with your money and kind of measured with how you've dealt with it. Do you think that's because of your past and how you've been brought up?
Yes, 1,000,000%. You know, my parents would instill it into me that you work for what you want. You, if you can't afford it, you know, like when we got married, we bought secondhand furniture. It's just how we were brought up. But my biggest thing was, yes, like you, I'm very aware that a lot of lottery winners lose it all in quite a short space of time. My one thing I kept telling myself was to win it and lose it would be worse than never winning it. So, yeah, I was aware that I had to look after it.
What a sensible woman. Susan Herdman. That scene of her going to the karaoke with the winning ticket in her bra makes me laugh so much. It's so brilliant. She also, in the conversation, talks about her relationships and how they were affected by the money she won and the problems which money just can't solve. So now you know a little bit of what to expect if you ever do win the lottery. Thank you so much to Susan. And thank you for listening to this episode of Changes Revisited. If you're intrigued to hear more from either Joanne or Susan, do of course go back and listen to the full episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And do subscribe to Changes while you're there. It helps us so much to be seen. We release episodes every single Monday and we will be back next week, Easter Monday, with another episode of Changes Revisited to go with all that chocolate. See you then.